The Doctrine of Original Sin by Jonathan Edwards. The great objection against the imputation of Adam's sin to his posterity considered. To such imputation is unjust and unreasonable, inasmuch as Adam and his posterity are not one and the same, with a brief reflection subjoined of what some have supposed of God imputing the guilt of Adam's sin to his posterity, but in an infinitely less degree than to Adam himself. That we may proceed with a greater clearness in considering the main objections against supposing the guilt of Adam's sin to be imputed to his posterity, I would premise some observations with a view to the right stating of the doctrine, and then show its reasonableness, in opposition to the great clamor raised against it on this head. I think it would go far towards directing us to the more clear conception and right statement of this affair, were we steadily to bear this in mind, that God, in every step of his proceeding with Adam, in relation to the covenant or constitution established with him, looked on his posterity as being one with him. And though he dealt more immediately with Adam, it yet was as the head of the whole body, and the root of the whole tree. And in his proceedings with him he dealt with all the branches as if they had been then existing in their root, from which it will follow that both guilt or exposedness to punishment, and also depravity of heart, came upon Adam's posterity, just as it came on him, as much as if he and they had all coexisted, like a tree with many branches, allowing only for the difference necessarily resulting from the place Adam stood in, its head or root, of the whole. Otherwise, it is as if in every step of proceeding, every alteration in the root had been attended at the same instant, with the same alterations throughout the whole tree, in each individual branch. I think this will naturally follow on the supposition of there being a constituted oneness or identity of Adam and his posterity in this affair. Therefore, I am humbly of opinion that if any have supposed the children of Adam to come into the world with a double guilt, one, the guilt of Adam's sin, another, the guilt arising from their having a corrupt heart, they have not so well conceived of the manner. The guilt a man has upon his soul at his first existence is one and simple, namely, the guilt of the original apostasy, the guilt of the sin by which the species first rebelled against God. This, and the guilt arising from the depraved disposition of the heart, are not to be looked upon as two things distinctly imputed and charged upon men in the sight of God. Indeed, the guilt that arises from the corruption of the heart, as it remains a confirmed principle, and appears in its consequent operations as a distinct and additional guilt. But the guilt arising from the first existing of a depraved disposition in Adam's posterity, I apprehend, is not distinct from their guilt of Adam's first sin. For so is not in Adam himself. The first evil disposition or inclination of Adam to sin was not properly distinct from his first act of sin, but was included in it. The external act he committed was no otherwise his than as his heart was in it, or as that action proceeded from the wicked inclination of his heart. Nor was the guilt he had double, as for two distinct sins, one, the wickedness of his will in that affair, another, the wickedness of the external act caused by it. His guilt was all truly from the act of his inward man, exclusive of what the motions of his body were no more than the motions of any lifeless instrument. His sin consisted in wickedness of heart, fully sufficient for, and entirely amounting to, all that appeared in the act he committed. The depraved disposition of Adam's heart is to be considered two ways. One, as the first rising of an evil inclination in his heart, exerted in his first act of sin, and the ground of the complete transgression. Two, an evil disposition of heart continuing afterwards, as a confirmed principle that came by God's forsaking of him, which was a punishment of his first transgression. This confirmed corruption, by its remaining and continued operation, brought additional guilt on his soul. In like manner, depravity of heart is to be considered two ways in Adam's posterity. The first listing of a corrupt disposition is not to be looked upon as sin distinct from their participation of Adam's first sin. It is, as it were, the extended pollution of that sin through the whole tree, by virtue of the constituted union of the branches with the root, or the inheritance of the sin of that head of the species and the members in their consent and concurrence with the head in that first act. But the depravity of nature remaining is an established principle in a child of Adam, and is exhibited in after operations as a consequence and punishment of the first apostasy thus participated, and brings new guilt. The first being of an evil disposition in a child of Adam, whereby he is disposed to approve the sin of his first father, so far as to imply a full and perfect consent of heart to it, I think, is not to be looked upon as a consequence of the imputation of that first sin, any more than the full consent of Adam's own heart, in the act of sinning, which was not consequent on the imputation, but rather prior to it in the order of nature. Indeed, the derivation of the evil disposition in Adam's posterity, or rather the coexistence of the evil disposition implied in Adam's first rebellion, in the root and branches, is a consequence of the union that the wise author of the world has established between Adam and his posterity, but not properly a consequence of the imputation of his sin, nay, is rather antecedent to it, as it was in Adam himself. The first depravity of heart and the imputation of that sin are both the consequences of that established union, but yet in such order that the evil disposition is first and the charge of guilt consequent, as it was in the case of Adam himself. The first existence of an evil disposition amounting to a full consent to Adam's sin no more infers God being the author of that evil disposition in the child than in the father. The first arising or existing of that evil disposition in the heart of Adam was by God's permission. Who could have prevented it, if he had pleased, by giving such influences of his spirit as would have been absolutely effectual to hinder it, which, it is in plain fact, he did withhold, and whatever mystery may be supposed in the affair, yet no Christian will presume to say it was not in perfect consistence with God's holiness and righteousness, notwithstanding Adam had been guilty of no offense before. So root and branches being one, according to God's wise constitution, the case in fact is that by virtue of this oneness, answerable changes or effects through all the branches coexist with the changes in the root. Consequently, an evil disposition exists in the hearts of Adam's posterity, equivalent to that which was exerted in his own heart when he ate the forbidden fruit, which God has no hand in, any otherwise in and not exerting such an influence as might be effectual to prevent it, as appears by what was observed in the former chapter. But now the grand objection is against the reasonableness of such a constitution, by which Adam and his posterity should be looked upon as one, and dealt with accordingly, in an affair of such infinite consequence, so that if Adam sinned, they must necessarily be made sinners by his disobedience, and come into existence with the same depravity of disposition, and be looked upon and treated as though they were partakers with him in his act of sin. I don't have room here to rehearse all of Dr. Taylor's vehement exclamations against the reasonableness and justice of this. The reader may at his leisure consult his book and see them in the places referred to below. Whatever black colors and frightful representations are employed on this occasion, all may be summed up in this: that Adam and his posterity are not one, but entirely distinct agents. But with respect to this mighty outcry made against the reasonableness of any such constitution by which God is supposed to treat Adam and his posterity as one, I would make the following observations. It signifies nothing to exclaim against plain fact, such as a fact, the most evident and acknowledged fact, with respect to the state of all mankind, without exception of one individual, among all the natural descendants of Adam, as makes it apparent that God actually deals with Adam and his posterity as one, in reference to his apostasy and to its infinitely terrible consequences. It has been demonstrated and shown to be, in effect, plainly acknowledged that every individual of mankind comes into the world in such circumstances, as that there is no hope or possibility of any other than their violating God's holy law, if they ever live to act at all as moral agents, and being thereby justly exposed to eternal ruin. And God either thus deals with mankind because he looks upon them as one with their first father, and so treats them as sinful and guilty by his apostasy, or, which will not mend the matter, he, without viewing them as at all concerned in that affair, but is in every respect perfectly innocent, nevertheless subjects them to this infinitely dreadful calamity. Adam by his sin was exposed to the calamities and sorrows of this life, to temporal death and eternal ruin. This is confessed, and it is also in effect confessed, did all his posterity come into the world in such a state, is it to certain consequences are being exposed, and justly so, to the sorrows of this life, to temporal death and eternal ruin, unless saved by grace, so that we see God in fact deals with them together, or as one. If God orders the consequences of Adam's sin with regard to his posterity's welfare, even in those things which are most important, and in which in the highest degree concern their eternal interest, to be the same with the consequences to Adam himself, then he treats Adam and his posterity as one in that affair. Hence, however the matter be attended with difficulty, fact obliges us to get over it, either by finding out some solution, or by shutting our mouths and acknowledging the weakness and scantiness of our understandings, as we must in other innumerable cases, where apparent and undeniable fact, in God's work of creation and providence, is attended with events and circumstances, the manner and reason of which are difficult to our understandings. But, to proceed secondly, we will consider the difficulties themselves insisted on and the objections of our opposers. They may be reduced to these two. First, that such a constitution is injurious to Adam's posterity. Secondly, that it is altogether improper, as it implies falsehood, viewing and treating those as one which indeed are not one, but entirely distinct. First difficulty, that appointing Adam to stand in this great affair as a moral head of his posterity, and so treating them as one with him, as standing or falling with him, is injurious to them, to which I answer, it is demonstrably otherwise, that such a constitution was so far from being injurious to Adam's posterity, any more than if everyone had been appointed to stand for himself personally, that it was in itself considered attended with a more eligible probability of a happy issue than the latter would have been, and so a constitution that truly expresses the goodness of its author. For one, it is reasonable to suppose that Adam was as likely, on account of his capacity and natural talents, to persevere in obedience as his posterity, taking one with another, if they had all been put on the trial singly for themselves. And supposing that there was a constituted union, or oneness of him and his posterity, and that he stood as a public person, or common head, all by this constitution would have been assured to partake of the benefit of his obedience, as of the ill consequence of his disobedience, in case of his fall. And number two, there is a greater tendency to a happy issue in such an appointment than if everyone had been appointed to stand for himself, especially on two accounts. One, that Adam had stronger motives to watchfulness than his posterity would have had, and that not only his own eternal welfare lay at stake, but also that of all of his posterity. Two, Adam was in a state of complete manhood when his trial began, It was a constitution very agreeable to the goodness of God considering the state of mankind, which was to be propagated in the way of generation, that their first father should be appointed to stand for all, for by reason of the manner of their coming into existence in a state of infancy, and their coming so gradually to mature state, and so remaining for a great while in a state of childhood and comparative imperfection, after they were become moral agents, it would be less fit to stand for themselves than their first father to stand for them. If any man notwithstanding the thing shall say that for his own part, if the affair had been proposed to him, he should have chosen to have had his eternal interest trusted in his own hands, it is sufficient to answer that no man's vain opinion of himself is more fit to be trusted than others, alters the true nature and tendency of things, as they demonstrably are in themselves. Nor is it a just objection that this constitution has an event proved for the hurt of mankind, for it does not follow that no advantage was given for a happy event in such an establishment, because it was not such as to make it utterly impossible there should be any other event. Number 3. The goodness of God in such a constitution with Adam appears in this, that if there had been no sovereign gracious establishment at all, but God had proceeded only on the basis of mere justice, and had gone no further than this required, he might have demanded of Adam and of all of his posterity that they should perform perfect perpetual obedience, without ever failing in the least instance on pain of eternal death. It might have made this demand without the promise of any positive reward for their obedience. For perfect obedience is a debt that everyone owes to his Creator, and therefore is what his Creator was not obliged to pay him for. None is obliged to pay his debtor for discharging his just debt. But such was evidently the constitution with Adam, that an eternal happy life was to be the consequence of his persevering fidelity, all such as were included within that constitution, of which the tree of life was a sign, as well as eternal death to be the consequence of his disobedience. I come now to consider the second difficulty, it being thus manifest that this constitution by which Adam and his posterity are dealt with as one is not unreasonable on account of its being injurious and hurtful to the interests of mankind. The only thing remaining in the objection against such a constitution is the impropriety of it, as implying falsehood and contradiction to the true nature of things, as hereby they are viewed and treated as one, who are not one, but wholly distinct, and no arbitrary constitution can ever make that to be true which in itself considered is not true. This objection, however specious, is really founded on a false hypothesis and wrong notion of what we call sameness or oneness among created things, and the seeming force of the objection arises from ignorance or inconsideration of the degree in which created identity or oneness with past existence in general depends on the sovereign constitution and law of the supreme author and disposer of the universe. Some things are entirely distinct and very diverse, which yet are so united by the established law of the Creator that by virtue of that establishment they are in a sense one. Thus a tree grown great and 100 years old is one plant with a little sprout that first came out of the ground from whence it grew, and has been continued in constant succession, though it is now so exceeding diverse many thousand times bigger and of a very different form, and perhaps not one atom the very same, yet God, according to an established law of nature, has in a constant succession communicated to it many of the same qualities and most important properties as if it were one. It has been his pleasure to constitute an union in these respects, and for these purposes naturally leading us to look upon all as one. So the body of man at 40 years of age is one with the infant body which first came into the world, from whence it grew, though now constituted of different substance, and the greater part of the substance probably changed scores if not hundreds of times. And though it be now in so many respects exceeding diverse, yet God, according to the course of nature, which he has been pleased to establish, has caused that in a certain method it should communicate with that infantile body in the same life. the same senses, the same features, and many the same qualities, and in union with the same soul. And so with regard to these purposes, it is dealt with by him as one body. Again, the body and soul of a man are one, in a very different manner, and for different purposes. Considered in themselves, they are exceeding different beings of a nature as diverse as can be conceived. And yet, by a very peculiar divine constitution or law of nature, which God has been pleased to establish, they are strongly united and become one in most important respects. A wonderful mutual communication is established, so that both become different parts of the same man. But the union and mutual communication they have has existence, and is entirely regulated and limited according to the sovereign pleasure of God and the constitution he has been pleased to establish. And if we come even to the personal identity of created intelligent beings, will this be not allowed to consist wholly in what John Locke supposes, i.e., same consciousness? Yet, I think it cannot be denied that this is one thing essential to it. But it is evident that the communication or continuance of the same consciousness and memory to any subject through successive parts of duration depends wholly on the divine establishment. There would be no necessity that the remembrance and ideas of what is past should continue to exist, but by an arbitrary constitution of the Creator. If any should here insist that there is no need of having recourse to any such constitution in order to account for the continuance of the same consciousness, and should say that the very nature of the soul is such as will sufficiently account for it, its ideas and consciousness being retained according to the course of nature, then let it be remembered that who it is that gives a soul this nature, and let that be remembered which Dr. Taylor says of the course of nature before observed, denying that the course of nature is a proper active cause which will work and go on by itself without God, if he lets and permits it, saying that the course of nature, separate from the agency of God, is no cause or nothing, and affirming that it is absolutely impossible the course of nature should continue itself, or go on to operate by itself any more than produce itself, and that God, the original of all being, is the only cause of all natural effects. Here it is worthy also to be observed what Dr. Turnbull says of the laws of nature as cited from Sir Isaac Newton, quote, "It is the will of the mind that is the first cause, to give subsistence and efficacy to those laws who is the efficient cause that produces the phenomena, which appear in analogy, harmony, and agreement according to these laws," end quote. And the same principles must take place in things pertaining to moral as well as natural philosophy. From the things that will clearly follow, that identity of consciousness depends wholly on a law of nature, and so on the sovereign will and agency of God. And therefore, the personal identity and so the derivation of the pollution, guilt, to past sins in the same person depend on an arbitrary divine constitution. And this, even though we should allow the same consciousness not to be the only thing which constitutes oneness of person, but should beside that suppose sameness of substance requisite. For if same consciousness be one thing necessary to personal identity, and this depends on God's sovereign constitution, it will still follow that personal identity depends on God's sovereign constitution. And with respect to the identity of created substance itself and the different moments of its duration, I think we shall greatly mistake if we imagine it to be like that absolute, independent identity of the first being, whereby he is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Nay, on the contrary, it may be demonstrated that even this oneness of created substance existing at different times is merely dependent identity, dependent on the pleasure and sovereign constitution of him who works all in all. This will follow from what is generally allowed, and is certainly true, that God not only created all things, it gave them being at first, but continually preserves him and upholds him in being, this being a matter of considerable importance that may be worthy here to be considered with a little attention.